Coming up on today's episode of Econ Gold Podcast, we have Taylor Fraser. That sounds like a name that I recognise, Fraser. Outwit socks, Rob Fraser, correct. But this is Taylor Fraser. They share the same grandfather, I believe, or grandparents at least. They are a family-run business now. But Taylor is a CMO, but he's much more than that. He has a background in tech, which gives him the unique ability to take advantage of some of the Shopify features like MetaFields and MetaObjects to create some pretty compelling and interesting CRO optimizations, which we discuss in some depth in this episode and more coming up on the Econ Gold Podcast, sponsored by Senlay, the email, SMS, and reviews tool that everybody is switching to in D2C e-commerce for good reason. Incredibly cost-effective, great deliverability, top team. So do check them out. Link in the show notes below, or just Google Senlay. Also brought to you by Rewind, the app that backs up your store and saves you from a disastrous day, week, and or month, possibly even your business, because it backs everything up. Customers, orders, everything that you need to restore your store is saved by Rewind. Shopify doesn't do that for you, so make sure you add it to your store for complete peace of mind. And while you're there, get the staging site. If you're still doing stuff onto your live environment, stop right now. Do it on a staging site, especially if you're going to start messing around with MetaFields. And meta objects like we talk about in this episode. Don't do that on your live site. Do it on stage. Over to you, Taylor. Taylor, thank you so much for joining us today on the Econ Gold Podcast. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, we've had Rob on. What's the relation there? There is a relation. You got to just have the same surname, or are you actually related?
Yeah, not everyone catches it, but I guess simply put, our grandpas were brothers. So we're like second cousins, basically. So,
right.
Yeah.
Anyone looking at the birds in the background, just FYI, it's because it's morning here in Indonesia. So,
yeah, I'm trying. If you hear rain, it's where I'm from. So there's rain hanging around there. Yeah.
Up in Canada. Yeah. No, I wondered if you're a relation. I wasn't sure if you were like maybe brothers or something, but no, that makes a lot of sense. That's very cool. Is that how you got your foot in the door at Outway?
Yeah. I mean, Rob and I grew up on separate sides of the country. So he grew up in Toronto. I grew up on Vancouver Island, which is just a small island, just literally off the coast of Vancouver in Canada, and kind of knew who he was my whole life, but never really met him. And then in my kind of mid 20s, got to actually meet him when he moved here, and immediately we clicked. So I was doing my own thing. He was doing his own thing. And we would sort of meet up casually for coffee here and there and just talk shop. And then as my life kind of was changing and things were going on in my world, he was sort of doing his thing. And then he bought out his partners with the original brand. We've rebranded since. And just basically said, like, would you be interested in coming along and helping on with marketing? And so, I mean, at first I wasn't very interested, and then it slowly gained interest. And eventually it was like, all right, let's try this. So I think I tried like a 3-month contract or something like that. And after 3 months, I was like, oh, I really like this. Like, I'm learning a lot. And then he was like, oh, I like you being here. And it just kind of continued. And now it's been, you know, over 4 years, coming up on 5 years. And no looking back now. I love the decision I made. And we've both come a long way. So it's really exciting that we're still able to do this together. So
Outway Socks, technically a family business. You heard it here first, folks.
Yeah.
Now it is anyway. Beats washing cars, right? Beats washing cars and building apps.
Yeah. How did you know that?
Yeah, that was your first four, that was your first foray, wasn't it, into what became a kind of a tech focused role, I would say, based on some of the recent projects. And we're going to get into that today in today's show. But just talk us through like how you even got into marketing, because you didn't take a conventional route, did you?
No, I didn't. I mean, right out of high school, I got like a regular job. I was actually working in a cemetery, so not super regular job, but I worked there until I was like maybe 20. And
what do you do in the cemetery?
Well, basically, like, we would maintain the land, but like in between maintaining the grass and the gardens, you would like, you know, do burials and things like that. I was the lowest on the totem pole, so I was behind a weed eater most of the days, but you would get to help out with certain burials and certain tasks around the property. It was a huge property. So it was like, it was pretty interesting. But yeah, like, you know, it was like working at a golf course. By the end of it, you forgot that there were graves after a couple months. But yeah, it was pretty interesting. But, you know, I was making good money there. And I thought, you know, this is pretty cushy union job. You know, everyone was proud. You got, oh, you got a pension, all this stuff. And then when they would lay us off during the winter, during the rainy season, I was just like so bored. I'm not like the type of person to sit around and do nothing. And I was really lucky to have a friend that was making money online and kind of just gave me sort of hope that maybe I could learn online. It was interesting to me. Computers were really cool to me. And so I just like started really basic and just tried doing affiliate offers and did affiliate marketing for quite a while and made myself enough money that I was able to like quit my job quite quickly. And then from there, it was like game over. I was like up 24/7 learning as much as I could. And then I eventually got into kind of mobile apps, sort of like a little bit of development. I definitely needed a lot of help. I'm not a very good programmer at all. I just kind of a seamstress. I figure it out. And got into advertising, like mobile advertising, did that for a long time. And so for a good decade, I was just kind of making things work on my own. I was just by myself in my place and kind of, you know, with the blinds closed and just trying to figure out how the hell I can make money online and really just pretend, you know, like I was just a total imposter. And then near the end of it, I owned a car wash as well in town and tried to start a couple smaller projects that didn't work out. I tried to start like a rideshare app, but they just legislation wouldn't allow us to have rideshare. So that kind of went into the dirt and then sold the car wash. And then I was kind of at this weird, like felt like a midlife crisis kind of. I just didn't know what I was going to do because I didn't really feel like I was hyper skilled at anything, but I could just figure things out. I had a good business sense and I was really motivated. So I did like an 8-month course up island from here and just learned a little bit more about coding, just kind of confirming a lot of the stuff that I was already working on. And from there, I was just like, okay, I think I went the opposite. You know, a lot of people get like they get a safe job and then they take the swing in entrepreneurship. I did the swing much earlier in my life. And then I was like, oh, I want to like work for a company and work with a team and collaborate and like get something legit going. So Outway was a really good opportunity. I started with marketing. That was kind of my main role, but it very quickly led into just so many other things like the web development side, all the media buying. I've spent like so much time in Photoshop and AI and just kind of been able to put things together as are needed, you know. And when we're like a smaller team at the beginning, we're so scrappy. I got to try lots of different things. And, you know, now as we're sort of growing, I can delegate that, but it's nice being able to tinker and get in the weeds with all sorts of different stuff.
Yeah, man. So I'm always wary of people that say they own car washes because I immediately think they must be tied to some kind of organized crime group. I guess you just enjoyed washing cars, right? Up in Canada, well, must get pretty dirty.
Well, I mean, we live in like on Vancouver Island, we actually have pretty moderate climate. Like it's not as bad as people would think. We get like snow maybe a few days a year. Yeah, it rains a little bit, but it's not too bad here. We get nice summers, nice spring. But yeah, I'm still a car guy. I was a big car guy. I would wash my car there all the time. And eventually the owner was like, do you want to buy it? And I immediately was like, no way. I make money like in my pajamas at home. Like I'm not going to buy a car wash. And then right before he was like going to just close down the business and, you know, cancel his lease, he was like one Hail Mary. He's like, I'll give it to you for this amount of money. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'll try it. So I got a friend to join in with me and we owned it for a couple years and it was swamped busy. It took up all my time. We had like 7 or 8 full-time guys. We got as busy as that like building would let us be busy. And then it was like, okay, we either take these small salaries every year and work here 50 hours a week or we expand. And I didn't want to expand because it wasn't really what I expected to happen. And so we ended up being really lucky to sell it for as much as we did and got out of there. And it was a nice exit right on the 2-year mark. So we didn't have to pay taxes. It was just amazing. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Amazing.
A big exit.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah.
Can be done. All right. Well, look, this isn't about car washes, unfortunately, because I would actually like to know how car washes work. But this is what I thought would be an interesting way to take this episode is because I know and I recognize in your behavior at Outway some of the things that I see in myself, which is a bit of a pursuit of CRO and also leveraging some of the deeper technology of Shopify. And I say deeper because you've got a code based background, you've got at least an understanding of how the system's built, and that gives you a unique advantage, especially when Shopify brings out things that are perhaps not just drag and drop, but are very, very powerful. And one of those examples I saw recently on your Twitter page, which blew me away. I loved reading that thread. Thank you for putting that together. Anyone that wants to read it can go and check it out on your Twitter. But you used Metafields and MetaObjects to accomplish a task, which I've seen a lot of brands struggle with, actually, even off Shopify on platforms like Magento, where they've wanted dynamic information on product pages. So can you just give everybody, I want to deep dive into that for the next 5-10 minutes, and just give everybody a kind of backstory as to why you ended up creating this solution, and then we'll go into the solution itself.
Yeah, I guess like with our Shopify theme, anyone that's familiar with Shopify, when you build a product page, you build a template basically that holds that product. And if you're lucky enough to have, you know, one SKU, you know, you just have to build one template and that's it. You manage that one template and it's not a lot of work. But any business that has multiple SKUs that offer different things, even for us, like we sell socks, but like every sock is different. We have different sock heights. There's a different fabric that, you know, makes up the sock. So, you know, we've got tons of different SKUs. And so you end up making like so many different product templates. And the more templates you make, the more you have to manage, because the second you make one change to the product, you've got to go in and through and make all these changes to all these different templates. Yes. And make sure the upkeep. It's just still, it's a lot of work, and it very quickly becomes like a headache. And so I manage a lot of like the Shopify backend. I work with the ops team to do like a lot of the merchandising and like getting the product pages and just the overall optimization of the website. So I was just like going through and updating pages all the time. And I think we had like 18 product templates at a time at one time. You know, there's one for a hiking sock and one for an ankle, and one for an ankle knit, and one for a cord. Like it was just redundant. And so
mental. Yeah.
And the small amount of changes on each one of those templates was just not enough to warrant having its own template. So I was like, how can I make one template that understands what product it's showing to the customer, and then adjusts all of the data on the page based off of what type of product it is? Yes. So I just like started researching really simply, and it just was like, oh, like this meta object thing exists in meta fields. And I had kind of used meta fields a little bit for a couple random things. And then once I got familiar with meta fields, I was like, okay, like I see how this works. And then it was like, well, what's a meta object? Okay, a meta object is like a structure of data that holds multiple different types of meta fields. And it just started from like, okay, can I pass this data? Like, can I pass the description? That's it. Like, simply put, can I make it so that it queries the product and then shows the appropriate description for this SKU? Okay, yes, I got that. All right. So like, let's save that code. Let's figure that out. Okay. And I just slowly kept making it more and more complicated for myself. And then I just decided one day, like I wanted to do, on our product pages, we would have a tech features section. So it was like a banner that showed all of the different technical features of each sock. Well, you can imagine how many images we had to produce for 18 different templates, 18 different products. And then anytime something changed, we'd have to go into Photoshop, change this. And then on top of that, it's an image. So it's not even like it's indexing any sort of SEO based off of, there's no actual words being coded in. It's all just rasterized into an image, which isn't like the best for the page. So I was like trying to sort through the data. And so I just started making a plan, and it literally started from like a piece of paper, like organizing how our socks are broken down and building these data structures in the background. So labeling them all their correct things, building. I mean, it's one of those things where it's much easier to show, but essentially I just built I took every single part of every product and I inputted data on that product in the meta fields and then put them into meta objects so that it wasn't just a picture of a sock. It was like showing like it's a knit pattern. This is the materials and care. Here's the description. Here's the title. Here's the price. Here's the different technical features. Like every part of the sock became in a drop down right below. So if you go to your product pages down below at the very bottom, you can see there's a meta field area. Ours has like 25 different points of data on every product. So then now once you've put the data into each product, it exists. Now, can you use like Liquid and can you use code to actually manipulate and exploit that data and make different things in the page? So then, of course, my like background in web development, I know HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and Liquid pretty well. And so I was like, okay, I can marry the two together and make these really cool custom sections on the website that just query the page and completely change the entire page based off of this. So I hope I put that as simple as I could, but it's like, again, it's one of those things where if you walk someone through it, they're like, oh, this makes so much sense. It's so simple to see. But I can see how it's like super intimidating when you don't really know how it works. Because at one point I was like, I'm not even bothering with meta fields or meta objects. That's way above my head. And then once I got familiar with it, it just became easier and easier. And then I took on this huge project and basically turned 18 product templates into one. So we have hundreds of SKUs that are all working off one template. And it's like very efficient.
For those of you who haven't had your morning coffee, here comes the Finn Radford version of Taylor's Metafield escapade. Yeah, let's break that down because, yeah, sick, absolutely sick. And just the fact that you came up with this tells me that you are an absolute killer, in my mind anyway, in terms of like marketing. This is what I deem the kind of frontier of marketing, working with the technology that's available, working with the kind of exploiting the things that most can't or won't exploit. And this is, there's just so much opportunity in that area because so few people can access it. And there's actually very limited people like you who can have the attention span to code something and learn it, but also have the brain that will allow you to be creative and think of these things and mashing those together. Like, yeah, very, very, I've met a lot of developers, I've met a lot of marketers who don't tend to see that crossover that much. But awesome that you have it. So really pleased to have you on the show. So back to this. So imagine your product page and you are essentially, you've got those templates. Now, everything on that product page can be edited independently. The images, the videos, the descriptions, the price, everything that you see on your product page. Imagine putting a little square block around it, whatever it is, and then that then becomes dynamic and editable. That's essentially in the most basic form what you can do. And then what Taylor's then gone and done is written all of those little blocks that he wants as a meta field, which is just essentially a custom field for whatever you want to create and give it a name. And there you go, you've got your meta field, and can now interchangeably, either individually or as a group, change those and manipulate those things based on those custom parameters that he's set. And then you're moving on to doing even crazier stuff. But it's in a nutshell, rather than, like you said, going in and editing one whole page template with that Shopify drag and drop builder and then calling that template one and assigning that whole thing to a product, you're doing it on a kind of more dialed in. I can just change these elements on this page. To some degree, that's loosely a bad interpretation of what's going on. And then I've seen you do some even crazier stuff, like you said, with the banners. So what Taylor was explaining there is one of the banners on the product page for one of the socks would just be a white representation of that socks with the USPs or the value propositions for the socks in general. But you'd be looking at a beautiful sock design, and then you just see the white sock as an image with the kind of five or six USPs as an image. And that's a banner, and that's great. And it works across pretty much all your products, I imagine. What you then went and did by being able to understand what the customer is looking at on the product page, i.e. that product, you're then dynamically generating that image in. And not only that, the banner is now a dynamically generated banner with actual text, not an image anymore. So you can see how it starts to become a very, very powerful thing when you start to replace elements and start to dial in that personalization to the product page, not just the customer. So, yeah. Okay, that is a kind of way of explaining it. So just tell us why you even thought about doing this in the first place, because ultimately, does it improve speed and efficiency? Does it improve CRO? Like, what were the main ambitions for the project?
Yeah, I think, I mean, first off, it was like, I like to keep things really like clean and simple. So seeing 18 product pages just bothered me in general, my own personal, you know, wanting to keep things clean. And then just the time and inefficiency. And then also just like the disconnect, you know, I think with socks, like, you know, we've ran landing pages a lot in the past and we don't really see a ton of performance from landing pages because the reality is a lot of people understand what socks are. We don't really have to educate customers on like what a sock is. We just have to sort of show that our socks are probably the best solution for, you know, maybe what they're looking for. And so a lot of that can be achieved on the product page. And so I kind of changed my whole mindset of, instead of making a landing page in between, you know, the click of the ad and the product page, why not just make the product pages more compelling and they can get all their information on there? And so when I kind of shifted that, it made me question our product page in general. And the biggest sore thumb on the product page was these disconnected images that, you know, you would see a sock with trees on it and it was a beautiful sock, but you'd scroll down and see all these generic images to represent what our socks are. I thought it just doesn't feel custom. It doesn't feel like it's really speaking uniquely to the customer. You know, we're assuming that a customer's going to like 50 different products. They might be going to a few. So it just started from like trying to itch that and then being like, how can I do this in a meaningful way? And I just went down this rabbit hole. But, you know, I guess like the simplest way to put the dynamic explanation of it is, you know, if someone went to your product and you had an actual picture in the wild of someone wearing that product, you wouldn't want to make a different template for every product to switch the image. Instead, you have one template, you attach that product image in the back end, and then that dynamic block knows to switch the image to the relevant image, you know, on the product page. So that's essentially what we did. And it goes even like deeper with that tech banner, because then you're taking into account that it's one section of code. So it's about 600 lines of code, which it actually, that isn't very much a code, like when you account for even the dead space and stuff, but it also takes into account the type of sock that it's showing. And then it adjusts the size and the orientation of where the image sits on the text based off of the image. And then it does all responsive design. So I like went full nerd on this thing. It was pretty fun to build, but and I ended up doing it to the collection banners as well. And now I'm kind of, it's been about a month or so. And now I'm like, okay, what else can I turn into a meta object? Like, I just want the entire store to be like stored in meta fields and meta objects. But
Yeah, man, it's awesome to see. And going back to that product page thing, I love what you said there without like removing that step and just having it sent to the product page, because there was such a faux pas about don't drive traffic from Facebook to a product page, drive it to a listicle or a landing page and quiz and then there. And that's fine. That is fine. But there are some brands that do an incredible job of telling a story and creating a journey on their product page. Where I've always thought about product pages is the top above the fold of a product page has the buy button, because if someone's ready to buy and they just want to get it in their basket, they don't need convincing. They're at that stage of the funnel. Just let them do it quickly, ubiquitously. I think everyone accepts that. But if they are not ready to buy, the first thing they're going to do is scroll, right? Is scroll. So the next cascading part of your product page just needs to be objection handling, why you should buy this product. And that's all it needs to be. And I've seen some incredible examples of this. And a very early example of what you were doing was a company called Jing Tea. This is back in Magento days, but they had upwards of like a 6% conversion rate. And because what they were doing on their product pages was each product, and it was a lot more than 600 lines of code, but each product at that time had a complete story dedicated to it. So, for example, you're buying a tea bag, and this tea was from Sri Lanka, picked by this farmer, in this climate, from this batch. That whole story was told on the product page in a beautiful way, specifically for that product. And then it even had like particular brewing instructions for this particular tea, you know, just an incredible experience on the product page. That's sort of what you're getting towards there. I see it. And I think going the extra mile and changing those banners was so necessary as well to do that, because it brings that whole thing together. Because it wasn't, you know, great, you can stop at Metafields, but being able to do things like that really starts to elevate that product page experience. So how has it actually translated into a better experience for the customer? Have you got any metrics on it?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely have had an increased conversion rate, like as we've gone. Every metric in our store just always seems to be going upwards very slowly but surely. And so sometimes it's hard to attribute like what could have it been, because, you know, while I'm fixing the product pages, I'm also doing a ton of other things. And, you know, when you're moving that quickly and you're doing so many different things, it's hard to sort of stop and be like, well, what actually, you know, changed, you know, or what actually helped us there. So I definitely will say that I don't think that it made us go backwards, which is definitely like my baseline. Did it make it worse? No, it didn't. So yeah, it is, which is good. So like we're growing and things are going well. The page loads quickly and there seems to be less CX tickets. Like it just, all those kind of metrics, you can kind of have a gut instinct on a lot of things with the with these things. And especially when you benchmark like other brands and you see what they're doing, it's like we can't all be getting it wrong here. This, you know, if you benchmark the right brands, then you can make the gut instinct call that it's probably doing good. But yeah, I don't have like specific metrics of, oh, since we brought the tech banner in, like we've increased it by this much.
I don't think that exists though. Like this is another thing that I don't get annoyed about it, but I think we're so short-sighted a lot of the time. What you just said there, constantly moving upwards and to the right, small incremental improvements. But I think that is the true mark of all of these things coming together over time, because like you see so many people like make a change, like the checkout, for example, when they did that one-page checkout. Yeah, okay, that's a bit more of an obvious thing. You know, it should decrease friction and have a pretty significant instant effect on conversion. But it's like, it was one of those things where I think we just put too much emphasis on this is going to just add a percent. Like, what does that actually mean? Like, okay, some customers prefer it. Maybe some don't. Maybe some are more traditional and they're used to a different checkout. Like, there's so many parameters, but as long as what you did was objectively good and objectively better for the experience, over time, that should prevail. And doing that over and over and over and over again, you'd imagine, does constitute a slightly upwards and to the right moving. Better conversion, better graph. I think it's all those things. So what happens next then? Because what my mind starts doing now is going, wow, Mark, you've got all these meta fields and then you've got customer data as well. You understand your customers. Could you start creating custom pages per customer now? Like, what are the other things that this allows you to do? Do you think about those kinds of things?
Yeah, I think about them. But, you know, Q4, it's really tough to take on projects like that. I think we've got a couple projects that we're going to be launching next year that are, you know, based around just less customer friction. They're not so much with meta fields and meta objects. Like, we want to do a pack builder just because we have predetermined packs that we do with the Shopify bundle app. But, you know, we would love there to be an a la carte sort of, you know, page on the website where people could build their own packs. And then based off of what they get, they can, you know, retain a certain discount based on the volume they get. And so those projects would more likely not require any meta fields or meta objects. Perhaps they could. I haven't gotten to that part yet. But yeah, I think right now I'm pretty satisfied with the product pages. I think the other thing I would like to add is a lot more photography and images in the wild of these socks actually in use. The hard part is like we have these high performance socks, but the people use them for so many different things. We have people that are hardcore road cyclists and hikers and people that are runners. And so we got to be really careful, like what kind of images you share on the product page, because you don't want to deter people from being, you know, feeling like, oh, I think this might be a running sock, even though it's not, by putting those type of images on. So I'm trying to figure out a way that I can have a nice healthy mix of different images on the product pages that show the socks actually in use. And I've already built the component for it, but now I guess the next part is just getting the team together and doing a huge archive of photos and putting them all together and adding them to the products. But
I imported a bulk import of products into Shopify, and I did not put in the meta fields the created date, and that sent the whole filtering system haywire, because you could no longer filter collections by newest in first or date added to the website, which was a really big problem for this quite large fashion brand. If I didn't have Rewind, that would have been a complete pickle. It would have taken hours, if not days, to sort out all of the while these products are live and really messing up their merchandising. A mistake by me, absolutely. But fortunately, I had the foresight to install Rewind before I made any of these changes. And I was able to just click a button, restore the site back to a previous version just a few minutes before I made that fatal error. And no one was any the wiser. That's the value of Rewind. That's just one use case, okay? One use case. There are hundreds of other use cases. Have it on there, because when you need it, you'll text me or you'll tweet me and say, thank you so much, Finn, for recommending that I installed Rewind. You saved my bacon. Back to today's show.
Can you take that a step further? Maybe you've already thought about this, but use the URL from the ad that you're running. If you're running a running ad or a cycling ad, you know I'm going with this. And then take that URL, pass it through to Shopify, and then generate the product page with those images to reflect the context of the ad. Whether if it's a running ad, generate a running ad page.
Yeah, that's a totally, like, that's where my head goes with things. And then I'm like, well, you're too deep, too deep. Yeah. I gotta go back. Cause like at the end of the day, like who's got to do it? I have to do it. And there's a lot of other things I got to do. So I think that deeply about some things. And then sometimes you get to a point where you're like, does it matter? Like, I don't know. And like, how far is too far until the customer just, you know, wants to be more assured in the decision they're making. And so, yeah, again, we've done landing pages before. We've tried all sorts of different things. The only landing page that we've actually had decent success with actually allowed the person to buy on the landing page. So that's kind of also what confirmed
this. What's the difference between that and a product page in my head?
Not really a lot, but that's kind of where the aha moment was like, I've basically just made a product page with a different order of sections, and it's just made in a different builder, and it's now just becoming a product page. So it's almost like went back and into itself. And I'm like, okay, we've almost reverse engineered a product page into a landing page. We might as well go back to a product page. So yeah, that was kind of part of that light bulb moment. And so far, so good.
Yeah, definitely. And just to round off this section, I mean, you don't have, I don't think you have, you know, particular problems with deliverability and things like that, but you could also, I don't know if you did this with the meta fields, do things with like delivery dates. You could do things with like filters. Did you take it over to the category pages yet or not? Have you done any meta field or meta objects over there?
Yeah, I have. I've done most of the meta fields I've done is through collections and products. Although I definitely look into the other ones and kind of go, okay, what could we do here? Like you said, with like customizing other parts of the experience. But yeah, so far we're just at product pages and collections. But I think like doing the product page for me, even if at the end of it, you know, Rob was like, hey, I don't like this tech banner, let's get rid of it, it wouldn't even bother me because I learned so much through that process that pretty much once we decide what we want to do, I know exactly how we can tackle it, whether it's me or whether it's someone else, I know how to like build it. So that in itself was like the biggest benefit to doing this. And also too, like, I looked everywhere online for help around this, and there was nothing. There's no information, good information about meta fields or meta objects. I had to like make a lot of friends on Twitter and, you know, befriend some people to be like, hey, am I doing this correctly? And get some like, you know, insights from people. And I think like it was kind of cool too, because a lot of people were messaging me being like, man, I didn't even know that existed. Can you show me how to do it? And so like, I'll hop on calls with people and be like, this is how you can do it, like at a very basic way. So it's opened up like a lot of doors for me. That's not just about the product page. So
yeah, I mean, I have had experience with it through migrations. I did a lot of migrations from Magento. Magento is a highly custom development. It's an open source platform, so build anything on it. And people used it for like 8 years. So you can imagine what the code base looked like at the end of that. And then they want to move to Shopify and they've got a gazillion customizations on all their products. And then you have to map those into meta fields, and that, thank God, there's an incredible piece of tech that will help you do that. But, and I was going to say as well, there is, I think it's called Matrixify, and you can export all of your meta fields and dump them into someone else's store. So like, just saying, if you speak to Taylor nicely enough, he might help you out. There's a few tools that are knocking about. So all right, Q4, let's just dive into that. First, what I really love about the store is the design. Like, it really resonates with me. I am probably the target market, but it's really like, you can tell that so much thought has gone into it. Even as you have like overlapping images overlaying different like sections and things like that, there's just a lot of time gone into that. Is that part of, like, I know you're big on experience, so is that just something that you invest a lot of your resource in, is design?
Yeah, I mean, we've always had really talented designers, and so we've tried to give them like autonomy. Like, we basically set them onto the store and said, you know, take your time, present us with a design system for the brand. Let's almost like rebrand within the brand. Like, let's figure out our identity with the website. Let's take all the learnings from other sites, what's working, what's not, and let's almost like build the entire thing in Figma or Photoshop or whatever you like. And then let's ask ourselves, like, what part of this makes sense? And then how can we then design it? And so they produced like this beautiful homepage, and it all flowed so well. And then after like, obviously a bit of a feedback loop of, okay, this looks good, but it's maybe not best CRO. This looks, you know, this doesn't look great. We came up with this beautiful homepage, and then we just built it out. And from there, it was just kind of, it sort of like snowballed into just getting better and better. And like, we're actually pushing a new homepage update coming up very soon, which will probably blow this one out of the water. So we're like constantly questioning, like, are we doing the best that we can? And so, the biggest thing on our website is just like really clear, concise navigation. We try not to have the website confusing. In fact, right now the website is the most robust it's been. We've always kept like one or two things in the navigation, like really simple, shop all socks. Mm-hmm. And then from there you can distill it down into like, you know, bestsellers or new releases or sock kites and things like that. So we try to like really stay out of the customer's way, but then the people that are looking for something, they can still find something. They can read reviews or they can read our blog or, you know, get some support or whatever. But yes, friction-free is like what we go for.
Yeah. Navigation is always such a difficult one. Did you spend a lot of time actually testing navigation systems, or did you just go with gut?
Well, we test them. Like we don't, there's not really any way that we're like measuring the results of them, but we'll actually have like full on discussions around like the order of how the menu should be. And then like, you know, a month will go by and all of a sudden like it becomes a discussion again. And that's actually going to be in our next update, is like major navigation changes, actually working images into the navigation so that people can just like identify what they're shopping rather than reading. They can see more visual. And so, there's just a constant questioning of what are we doing and can we be doing this better? And it just becomes like this king of the court situation where it's like, if as soon as we have something better, we let's push it. And then if it doesn't work out, we just retreat back to the old method. So but we try to think through it as much as we can. But yeah, you're right. It's like a lot of gut instinct. We're not, you know, reading studies and then being like, oh, we got to change the navigation. You know, we just check, we benchmark other brands, we see what works, and you also observe like how you shop in the wild. Like, you know, being a marketer, it gives you a bias, but sometimes when my marketing brain's turned off and I'm just simply checking shoes out, I'll catch myself. I'm like, oh, why did I click that? And you know, why was that so easy for me? Or we don't have that. Okay. And then I try to think how we can apply it to our brand. So just doing things like that, constantly questioning things is how we kind of get there.
Here, two tips of advice. This is an educational podcast, after all, for anyone listening. Two great places to look when you are looking at your navigation, because it is really one of those things that you just like, how do I measure this? One, look at your search. Who and what are they searching for? Does something come up in your search more than something else? Move it up in navigation. Move something down in navigation. Does it appear more in search? Really good way to understand whether you're getting the customer to the right place quickly enough, or whether they're getting frustrated and landing in search. And the second one is Baymard Institute. If you haven't heard of Baymard Institute, it is a company dedicated to consumer research on e-commerce, and they publish every year a guide, and you can literally test your own navigation on their website. You might have to pay for it. It's about $1,000 a year, 1,000 quid a year, but it has a huge amount of, you know, in pretty well done research, and especially in navigation. I've built a few navigation systems using that. Mega menu, not mega menu, simple, not simple, you know, and you ultimately end up in what's easiest for the customer. But yeah, navigation is always tough. And also when this new Apple headset comes out, I mean, what are we going to do then? What does a website look like then?
I'm pretty like heads down on what's working right now. I mean, within reason. I mean, yeah, I don't really, yeah, I guess just pretty much heads down for the most part. I'm always like curious and like looking at other things, but you know, I try not to be like what I call a busy idiot, where I'm just trying to do things for the sake of doing them. You know, they've got to kind of make sense. And also too, when you go on Twitter, it's really easy if you go through your feed to feel like you're not doing enough and everything you're doing sucks. And you're just like, oh my God, I'm like horrible at this. But you got to just kind of stick to what you know within reason, and then just allow certain information to change your mind as you go. But Yeah.
You are in the D2C space. If you have a brand that's selling online and you haven't at least had a demo with Sendlane, then one of two things is objectively true about you. You like setting money on fire. You like making your life more difficult. If neither of those things are true and you are an e-commerce brand and you are selling online, you do send emails, you do send SMS, you do have reviews, or at least like to collect reviews, then there is no reason for you not to at least have had a demonstration with Sendlane. They are built for e-commerce. They are the most modern platform with the best features, in my opinion, at the lowest cost. I mean, I'm not really sure what would be holding you back. Please go and check them out. Show notes below, they have an event coming up. You can still get tickets, I believe, for that event in San Diego. A link to the Commerce Roundtable in the show notes below as well. Please do go and check out Sendlane if you haven't already. Back to the episode.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to come around quicker than I think we all expect, but knowing what Apple are like, it will be just a nicer experience of what we're already used to, but maybe it will evolve. 12. What's working at the moment on Facebook, and what are you bullish about creative wise going into Q4? Well, we're already in Q4, but going into the season of holiday shopping.
This definitely differs between brands, but I would say like creative iteration is more important than copy iteration. Static image is great for us. Like, you know, we try videos, we do videos. I'd say we do like a 70-30 split right now. We try short, we try long form. We're not doing everything that we dream of doing in video right now, but you'd be surprised how far you can get with static images. So anyone out there that's like, feels like they're behind because they don't have videos, you can genuinely build huge amounts of revenue, like good, efficient ROAS with just compelling static images and constant creative iteration. So we have like top of funnel campaigns that we're just constantly testing. You know, like 1 month, I think we released like 35 ad sets in like 25 days. We're just like constantly feeding it with new ad sets. And that's like a marketing team of three people, but we're, you know, in an ad set being like, say, four creatives. And a lot of this stuff was static images, but we're just constantly putting things in, giving it like a good enough budget to give us, you know, an attribution window's worth of time and see how it does, monitor the results. And then we either double down on what's working or try different iterations of what's working. So we're not reinventing the wheel every single time we're doing a new creative. We're sometimes just doing a tweak to it. So I would say like you can win with more creatives than you're probably dropping. So someone that's maybe putting like three ad sets up a week, you should probably like triple that volume if you can. And most people can. If you have Canva or you have like YouTube and Photoshop and good photography, you can put together ads. I'm telling you, like I've put together ads at like 2 a.m. in Photoshop that are probably spelt wrong and they say something over top of the socks, and those ads will outperform long form videos that take us a week and a half to produce. So not overcomplicating it, but at the same time, observing what's working and then trying to like do more of that stuff and making sure that you have a good, healthy, diverse mix as well. Not just doing like one type of creative, but like trying to think of your Facebook, the Meta platform is like your own brand within Meta. So like, how are you going to brand your Facebook ads and then trying to diversify within that? So that's what,
the 2 a.m. ad. Was that the stacked ad?
That was a stacked ad.
Yeah. See, I think I have a theory on this. I think you missed dinner and I think you were dreaming about pancakes and that good Canadian maple. And you were like, you know what? Stacked. Because it looks like pancakes, man. And it's stacked pancakes. So
I know. I should have put syrup on it or something like that. You know, something that really. But yeah, Facebook's weird like that. You can put all of your brain power and thought and passion into an ad, and the one that does the best is the one you hate, or it's a DPA with shitty copy. And you're not alone. It happens to all of us. It happens to big brands, small brands, medium brands. It's just like, I think the only way that you can conquer Facebook is a lot of iteration, slowly moving your budgets up, keep your ad sets in learning. So like a lot of people, and we did this as well. Like we've made these mistakes where you're running an ad, it's doing $200 a day and it's crushing. You're running like a four ROAS. You're like, this is amazing. So you're like, let's run 600 to it. Well, every single time you change the budget over 10%, you're going to be kicking it out of learning. Now it's going to be relearning. You might as well have just deleted it and made a new copy of it. So just having the patience to like bump everything up like 9% a day, get yourself some like automation that does it, and just slowly and slowly just chip away day by day, and the snowball gets bigger, and you start going from spending 200 a day to 2000 to 4000 to 8000. Like it really gets rolling quickly.
That's a huge tip. I had no idea that was the case. I honestly didn't. I haven't been in the back end of Facebook, but I have actually, but I haven't been running ads like that. So anything over 10% bump, it just puts it back into learning again.
Well, the thing is like Meta is such a contentious issue. Like people will listen to this. They'll go on Twitter and rant about me and say, this guy has no idea what he's talking about. And okay, sounds good. Everyone has an opinion about Facebook. I've had talks with like people at Facebook that know what they're talking about. And they tend to say like keeping below 10% will keep it in learning mode. It won't kick it out. Some brands will report that they can do 20% and it's fine, but Facebook gives you a threshold of 10%. I'm lucky to have a couple of connections on the Facebook side that have like been really generous of like helping us along. And I get on phone calls with them semi often. And so I take their word for it. And also too, like it ends up working that way anyways. And when what happens is if you triple your budget on an ad set, yeah, it might do well that day, but then it just falls off a cliff a few days later and you're like, what? Like what's going on? And then you have to start again. So you're better off just to slowly increment things and then and feed more volume to the account if you can. And then there's people that will do the, you know, the 3-2-2 method, if anyone knows what that is, and they'll run CBO and then they'll call me crazy. Don't put lots of creatives in.
What is the 3-2-2 method in a nutshell?
It's like three ad sets with two headlines and two primaries. You run campaign budget optimization and you run Advantage Plus placements, and you basically just like have one winning ad set and then two testing ad sets, and you basically just like run them CBO, so it decides where it's going to put the budget and you just put it into that fire.
Bring back Ad Espresso. Do you remember Ad Espresso? I'm Massimo.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, back in the day that did all of that, but like 50 different versions. It was so good, that tool. And then Facebook actually took them out of the game.
Facebook's, if you ask me in 3 months, my like tips on Facebook, they might change. Facebook is ever changing. You have to just be okay with that. By the time someone watches this, I could be completely wrong, and that's okay. But that works for us. So,
what's the Black Friday strategy, Cyber Monday strategy, holiday strategy? What are you going into? Bundles, discounts? What are we talking?
Store-wide discount, pretty aggressive on the products that we're trying to clear out. We're obviously trying to retire a lot of designs so that we can bring in all the new stuff for next year. Just nice to like free up cash and free up the shelves and get fresh stuff in. So we'll have like a pretty aggressive discounting on that. And then kind of it staggers all the way down to like lower end discounts with our higher selling items. We're like going to have, I think it's an 8-day sale period. We just hope that we crush it, really. It's hard to say. It's a weird Q4 for people. Like,
why is it it's weird? Not bad. I'm seeing this.
Yeah, it's like flat for a lot of people, but you know. We're growing, like we're showing year over year growth, but at the same time, it's like the calm before the storm. We just never know. We've had Black Fridays that, you know, didn't do as well as we had guessed. And we've had Black Fridays that just completely blew us out of the water. And we were up all night packing orders for like weeks on end. So we just don't know what to expect, but we show up with our best tactics in place. And we just, hope that people want socks.
Mate, level it out over a decade, slow up with growth to the right. I reckon that's what it always looks like. If you operate, you operate. That's, it doesn't takes out those like ups and downs, doesn't it? Good and bad. Yeah. I want you guys to do, I don't know who did this, but it was a brand recently. They did skateboards and they were branded with Pokemon. I can't remember some of it, like there was like 10 decks, Pokemon branding. And then like there was 3 or 4 gold decks. So like, and you bought them blind. So you got them all in the same packaging. You unwrapped them, saw what deck you got. The ones that weren't the gold ones were still sick. And the ones that were the gold ones were obviously like great. And there was only very, very few of those. I'd love you to do something like that. Like a gold pack of socks that you don't know what's in them. It's like $5 or $10 to like, to play the game. I know you're not a big fan of like gamification stuff. Well, not the spinners, but like on checkout or something, like get a golden pack and then put in, 90%.
Well, we have mystery pair. So if you go to our if you hit checkout, you'll get the mystery pair, which is a pretty cool product. It's a good price. And you're getting like, a randomly selected best-selling design or something maybe that's retiring. That's always been pretty good for us. But we have kind of the conversation lately has been like talking about a little bit more collaborations and things like that. So,
That'd be sick.
Yeah. That's definitely not off the table for next year. Maybe get in bed with some sort of artist or brand.
Go and speak to Corbin over at Simple Modern. He's the licensing guru. He knows everyone and everything.
I think Rob might be friends with him, so that would be a good connection to talk to.
Yes, sweet. All right, I'm going to wrap this up with a very, very quick lightning round. What was the last thing that you bought online, D2C brand?
Oh, man. Oh, I bought one of those new Recover portable saunas and cold plunge baths.
Damn, man. You're a fellow plunger. I like it.
Yeah.
How you find
it? Yeah, the Nordic spa is expensive here, and after like a few trips, it's like, oh my God, it's like $80 a pop. So I've got a great place for both. And this brand popped up out of nowhere. I circled it for a long time. And then finally got one. It was pretty inexpensive, you know, so it was a pretty like pretty cheap thing to take a swing on, and I really like it. So then I end up buying the sauna, because getting in the cold plunge sucks when you haven't
counterintuitive, isn't it? Yeah, you've got to burn yourself up first before you get in, and then it feels great. I literally sit in the sauna until I feel like my heart's going to beat out of my chest, that I'm like,
yeah,
someone throw a bucket of water over me. And then it's kind of a nice relief getting into the, where it's never really nice, but it's a nicer relief. Have you done this? Have you done sauna, cold plunge, and then laid down in the sauna?
Yeah, probably. I mean, Rob and I will go to the Nordic sort of spa, like in our hometown. That's sort of one of our hangouts, as we do, is we'll just talk about work and go to do a circuit. Poor people in the spa listening to us talk about socks in the spa, but, we'll do like, steam and then dry and then cold plunge. And then they have like a salt room you sit in after, but sometimes we've gone back into the sauna. But yeah, it's like getting into the cold plunge. I'm actually pretty decent at cold plunging. I don't get like I can do it for like a decent amount of time, but not when you haven't gone into the sauna first. It's horrible.
No motivation. If I'm hot, I want to get cold. And if I'm cold, I want to get hot. But for anyone who's doing those rounds, go and try the sauna normal plunge, sauna normal plunge. And then the final one, go and lay on the top shelf in the sauna and close your eyes. It is trippy, like weird trippy, you know, just sort of all over the place. It's really cool. All right. If you could have dinner, anyone from history or alive today, sit down for one dinner with them, who would it be?
It's funny you ask this, because I ask this to people all the time. Or my favorite question is, you're being executed tomorrow. What's your last meal and what movie are you watching? Like, it's just interesting to see. Yeah, it's a bit morbid, but people thinking like, what's my
cemetery days coming through?
Exactly. Yeah. See you there. I'll give the same answer I gave last time. And I said Will Ferrell. And the reason being is that only if he was in character, which apparently he's in character all the time. So being at dinner with him and him acting like he does in any of his movies would just kill me, watching him just be himself. And I would probably not even have to say anything and just watch him do his thing. So yeah, I would say Will Ferrell.
100%. CEO for a day, or CMO for the day, however you prefer. Of one brand, your choice, who do you take?
I would say Ridge Wallet. I think there's a lot to learn from Sean. I think that's a really, really impressive brand that I've watched closely. I would just be infatuated with how they do things, how they've scaled, how they approach problems and think of things. It would be like kid in a candy store to go into that office, or I think they're pretty remote, but you know what I mean? Be a part of that network for even a day.
Yeah, man. Apparently shit posting gets you a long way in conversion rate optimization.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe shit posting, but he's probably one of the realest guys out there, and I appreciate 100%. It. So, yeah.
What color is your ridge?
What color is what?
What color is your ridge?
Oh, I got like a rose gold one. He sent a bunch to us, so I picked a rose gold. I wanted to try it out, but I'm liking the ones they've dropped. I want one of those fluorescent looking ones or the neon colored ones, but yeah, we'll see.
Sick. Yeah, for sure. All right, my friend, where can people get at you?
Best place to find me is on Twitter. It's Tay Fraes, TayFraes. Yeah, or if you go find Rob, you can probably find me commenting some cheeky remark under his post somewhere. So yeah, best place is on Twitter. Feel free to reach out to me with anything. If you need help with metafields or meta objects, always happy to jump on a call.
All right, sir. We'll speak again, I'm sure. Thanks very much for your time.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
That was Tay Fraes. Go and check out that thread that we discussed. It's really worth looking at, and actually follow him on Twitter while you're there, because he comes up with some really interesting thoughts, and just a good guy all around. So thanks very much, Taylor, and we will see you next week for another episode of the Ecom Gold podcast, brought to you by Sendly and Wonderwall.